Yeah, because I found like a lot of times I, you know, like before I hit record, we'll have like a really interesting conversation will go by and none of it was recorded. So I'm like, yeah, fuck it, just hit record.
Yeah. It's like the first 15 minutes and then like right when the recording ends and then the bangers start coming out.
Yeah, there should be a thing where it's a fake record button, but the whole thing's recorded and then there's a fake stop button.
Yeah.
You know, but
like a staging area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's good to just forget even the thing that the damn thing's recording.
Yeah, but, I mean, we used to do that just to kind of warm up, but it's like we've been doing this for a decade.
Also, yeah. Also, you know, someone in the Discord was like, when was the last time you guys even said the word Asian on the podcast? They didn't mean that in a bad way, by the way. They were they were just saying it was interesting how little that comes up. Though I am of the opinion that actually it is very much still a very Asian centric podcast, but it's just basically because we're Asian. not because we're focusing on Asian land. Specific. Yeah.
That was specific. Like that was one of the things we were that was in our mission statement when we bothered with that thing.
How's that?
It was never supposed to be like, oh, as an Asian, I just needed to put in my two cents about this issue. Like that's putting the cart before the horse.
Shouldn't it be inherent?
It should be. Because the ideal of it was the entire idea is that different people have these experiences that naturally color and flavor their take on this subject. But then it became this kind of like outside in perspective where you're supposed to be thinking as some avatar of a population.
Yeah, like you're trying to... Yeah, exactly. Like the eight... Okay, so this is a very interesting topic for me lately because I've been thinking about this a lot, which is... Like what you're saying, right? Like, I feel like a lot of the way people used to talk about race was very much, and Asians, I think this is what drove a lot of people crazy about it, is like, they wanted to define what it was, they wanted to manage and regulate, you know, and prescribe what it was, and it ordered, you know, and it prioritized certain aspects of it, and it was all bullshit. And it was all like, you know, sort of overeducated, underemployed type younger people talking, you know, talking a big game about the poor working class and the immigrant communities and this and that. And we should prioritize them first and all this shit. But really they meant themselves.
From their fucking sit-ins at Yale. Yeah.
Yeah. All this stuff. And then, you know, we spent a lot of time in the past, like, you know, calling this shit out. And then I realized that to call it out intellectually the way we did just sort of throws more fuel on the fire. There's mm-hmm. there really was no way to put an end to that with that, you know, because like I realized like so much of that stuff, like it lives off of like the criticizing of it, the pushback, the clapback, so to speak, against it was the literal fuel for the fire that it was, right? Like,
yeah, there was no way to defeat it by playing into it, even as a response. And I think that's where we, like, every time we made a misstep, it's when we fell for that trap, like going Twitter brigading or, like, you know, adding people and trying to, you know, wrestle them to the ground with debate. Like, it's a debate on a bullshit premise. It's that thing about wrestling a pig. You both get dirty, but only the pig likes it. So, like, we were...
That's a nice variation.
So that's what we were doing.
Only the pig likes it. No, I liked it. I don't think of it as a mistake. I just think of it as a necessary process.
No, I believe maybe mistake was too harsh because I think it was a growing process. I think all the
it was
bullshit,
mistaken. It was mistaken, but I don't think it
but
was
it
a
was
mistake.
Part of the learning process, and it kind of helped us kind of characterize the limits of this thing that we know we're up against and we're opposed to it, but we needed to know what this beast was. We need to characterize it essentially. But like from the perspective of time, it just seemed like this organized project to study this. It's ethnography. It's just a bunch of people sitting far removed from the actual population, trying to do like immersive ethnography on this group. And their only cover is that they happen to look like most of the people in said group. and their credibility is being sold outside the group. So it's essentially, it's like a, like in software, it's just basically bundling us up into an API and then selling access to it through them.
Yeah.
They're the one, they're the ChatGPT wrappers saying like, you pay us the money, we'll ferry your little queries through us to this amorphous, you know, this amorphous population that we're claiming we have full understanding of. And then through us, you will get the, you will get the correct answer that you are looking for.
Do you feel like the quote Asian American project is kind of dead?
I haven't heard that in several years. So
I don't know if it's something just because I stopped paying attention to it, or whether the, and I'm, by that I mean, you know, the whole fucking shit, like the whole complex of Asian American academic things being written about and political projects in connection with the Democratic Party and the fundraising and the this and the that and the, you know, and the publishing and the media app, you know, stuff. And, you know, I'm like, I feel like I haven't heard much about it in a long time, but I don't know if that's just me not paying attention.
I mean, you'd be more connected to, I mean, you're still on Twitter and stuff. So if you haven't heard it, then I'm fully willing to believe that.
But
it's
I don't follow that stuff on Twitter though. Like my Twitter is just about, I don't know what it's about, but it's not about that.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I think it's completely dead. It seems like a decadent last gasp thing. Mm. You know, it's part of the ZERP era, the zero interest rate era.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
It's this idea. It's kind of, to me, it's tied inextricably with like corporatized DEI, which is largely about like making sure that fat gains are distributed equitably. It's not about creation, right? It's not about building. It's about making sure that the already existing gains are simply distributed. Mm. It turns it like DEI efforts, like especially at the big companies, like, I mean, let's just say Google, although it's not the only culprit. It's basically like corporatized welfare, race-based welfare in its philosophy. It's simply say, oh, okay, we've been ignoring you, but you certainly need this, need the gains from our work. So we're going to make some effort to make sure you get it, or some small percentage of the actual population. That's cheaper for us in the long run anyway. We're not going to pay all Black people. We're just going to make sure some of y'all gets access to this. What's that all mean when that fat stash of gold doesn't exist or it's slipping away? Like the Asian American project seemed to be like a group level effort to kind of get ours while the getting was good.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much in question right now. Like, what does that mean when we're watching institution after institution fall apart? What's it mean to like make sure that some of ours get up in positions of power? Why do we want an Asian healthcare CEO getting shanked in the street? Like, is that the Asian American project, to get a CEO so fucking hated he gets shot coming out of his hotel? Like what is this?
Our friend Chong made a point that Chuck Schumer today, arch liberal senator from New York, tweeted at the New York City Council today and said that he is strongly recommending that the New York City Council abandon its plans to eliminate the standardized testing component of entrance into Stuyvesant High School, Bronx Science, and the other, what they call the selective admission schools in New York City. This was a major change because it was seen for a while by the Asian American project. It's surprising that we're talking about this, because I think we're talking about midlife stuff, but this suddenly came up, and I think it's very interesting. But we should turn to the midlife stuff. Theory, I think, for a while, right? Which I think I and some of you, I think, were pretty annoyed by this as well, was this feeling like Asian Americans were being targeted as a special minority group. They kind of treated us the way that they were always fearful that Jews would be treated, as a sort of like, privileged minority group that was sort of like overstepping its boundaries and stuff. And so in New York,
contained and weaponized,
we needed to be contained. Yeah. We were like a threat. Right. And it's funny because it was a lot of Asian liberals that were making these arguments that Asians were, you know, cheating. Asians were gaming the system. Asians were participating in the suppression of Black and Latino out of a sense of racial superiority. All this, like all the negative shit. And this was a strategy that was employed against Asians for a long time. And then suddenly Schumer today came out against, he basically said, guys, don't do this. Like, you know, you got to keep the fucking selective testing shit. Like, don't move to the equity stuff that you're trying to do. And, you know, just do. And I think, so Chong asked on Twitter, she was like, do you think that sort of generally, do you think this is related to the fact that Asian American voters shifted to the right? So many of us in New York voted Republican. I voted Republican. 40% of Queens, which is heavily Asian, voted Republican, voted Trump. I was like, you know what? I think it's more than that. I think it's a general shift by every group to the right against the Democrats. And they started realizing that all of these little games that they were playing playing off one minority group versus another and all this shit, it wasn't working because it wasn't just Asians that revolted. Blacks revolted, especially Black men, but Blacks in general, maybe not revolted. They still pretty heavily Democrat, but there was a noticeable shift to the right. Latinos revolted. They fucking revolted. Asians revolted. And in general, a lot of blue areas revolted. So I think, I guess what I'm saying is, and I'm talking with like Fred Lee, Professor Fred Lee from UConn one of the recent pods. It seems like that era of liberal politics is dead. It's just over.
It's dead.
And affirmative action is gone. It's dead. It's dead. It's all dead.
The underpinning abundance is gone. Like liberalism depends on abundance theory. It's saying that like, oh, we got to just railroad underperforming kids into these places because they're not going to have access to the fat paychecks, the fat gains from getting into higher education and the getting into a big corporation and the getting, you know, drawing paychecks for soul-sucking email jobs and being, you know, parasitizing the PMC, being a parasite, essentially, a corporate parasite like the rest of us. Like, if that's your political and ideological cause, it's bankrupt now, like literally bankrupt.
So was our problem under that model, that former model, that Asians worked too fucking hard and they were just, guys, you need to chill a little bit.
It's not fair because everyone else deserves a shot at their piece of the pie. It's a big pie, and you guys are taking two slices when you only deserve a third.
But underlying that, like, what was really going on? Do you think it was that Asians what was the problem that we were presenting? Like, why did we suddenly become a problem for the liberals? Is it because
for the Asians?
Why did Asians become a problem for the liberals? Like, why did they start having a problem with us? What is it about us that at that time seemed to be frustrating their politics? Like, is it because I don't know. I suspect that it had to do with I honestly don't know. I don't know why they had a problem with us, but
I think we fucked with the morality math, honestly. The liberal morality math, because there's a very genteel, like a very genteel in the very archaic sense of the term, very like Lord of the Manor, top down, like noblesse oblige, sense of morality to liberalism. It's, I have come up on the golden tower, right? I have ascended to the city on a shining hill. I just want all y'all to join me up here where it's so good. It is, I can't tell you guys how great it is. I'm so humbled. I'm checking my privilege every day. Like right after I check E-Trade, I check my privilege.
But we were into that. I mean, we were playing along with that shit. You know what I mean? Is it the...
I think we revealed the brass tacks of it. The actual mechanics of the system. Like we're talking about like, oh, ideally meritocracy is wonderful. You test, everyone is an equal shot. And then only the meritorious can ascend. I mean, I think what the Asians were proving is that you actually can't, they couldn't find a way to keep us down fast enough. Like whatever rule you set, we were hell bent on beating it. Because I mean, the level of intense resentment and frustration that I hear when there's like sociologists talking about like, well, if we can't really point to poverty as an issue here, because if we just go by poverty, we see that poor Asians still make the skill score way higher on these standardized tests than like poor Latinos and Blacks at the exact same income range. Mm. Right. Yep. So it pokes a lot of holes where it was like a plank for liberalism to never look at economics, never look at the actual like foundational structures that guide society, and really rely on the soft metrics, culture, like vague, like trends in the mood. Like they're very big on like generalizing literal generations. They're trying to characterize literally people by age. That's how fucked this is.
Would you agree, though, that like that liberalism, however, was not some idealist project in that sense? That I think that a lot of that had to do with ideology, which is not idealist in the sense that liberals were truly committed to like some sort of spiritual change, right? What they were interested
in. I am. Shan walked by and I literally waved at the screen.
Your camera's like, hey, not girl. Even on.
It's not. I don't even have one. But I'm just like, oh, hey, girl. And I'm like waving at the screen. Ugh, man.
She can't hear or see you.
I know.
Wait, hold on. Hey, baby. Come here. Here, put this on. It's Jess. She wants to say hi.
Hey, Jess.
Hey, Shan. I was just telling Teen, I saw you walk by and I literally waved at the screen. My camera isn't on. Can't see me at all, but I waved at you anyway. Oh, hey, I can see you. Hey.
Yeah, I was like, where are you? I tried to look for you.
Hope you all are doing good.
Yeah. Everything good. How about you?
Oh, can't complain.
Okay, good. I was like kind of thinking of you the other day.
Oh, I think of you too. Hope you guys are doing good this holiday season.
We gotta go visit, baby.
Yeah, I know.
Yes,
I know.
Please.
We just have so much thing, you know.
I know. Online. It's always
it
one thing or another.
Do anything.
Yeah. That's the way. Yeah.
Yeah, you should do more pod with Teen.
Yeah, I'm gonna. Yeah. I have nothing going on right now. So.
Okay, good. Then do That's more good. And then just save it. Maybe, you know, he can release it once in a while.
Yeah.
I'm sure people miss your voice.
Oh, sweet. All right. All right. I'll do it.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, do you, Gala Chan, like, have another pet?
Do I have another pet?
Yeah.
I have a cat.
Oh, you got a new one?
Oh, she always had a cat.
No, I always had a cat, yeah.
Oh, you have two.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gotcha. Good. Just curious. Because I saw so many, like, cat for, like, adoption, and they're so cute. I really want
Get one.
Yeah, but I don't think our building allowed to have one yet.
So. Oh, yeah, okay.
But I just saw
they're really nice
online, and then it kind of remind me of you.
Oh, I'm flattered.
So cute. Yeah. Okay, well, I will get you back to Teen so
okay.
I can continue. Really good to talk to you.
Likewise. We'll talk more later.
All right. So where were we?
No
about?
Idea. Sorry. You were talking about like liberalism based on ideology.
Oh yeah. So I don't think that like that that liberals were actually committed to any sort of idealist transformation or change, any idealist politics in the sense that they cared about the actual.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Spiritual nature of like society, you know, they don't care
because
about
they were
that
never stuff. Willing to actually drill down into actual things that would get them closer to that ideological goal.
Yeah, I think what it was a head fake. I think I'm properly cynical about them, which is that I think the whole thing was just to make their constituents focus on intractable problems of equity, of identity, authenticity, justice, historical justice, huge questions that simply have no practical simply have no practical resolution, so that we would just be sort of constantly mired in their political project with no end.
Yeah, it's a. Meanwhile,
they would attend to their own private corruption. We would not be paying attention to what was going on, and they would just steal all the fucking money, just like BLM did.
Right. So I think we expose the raw mechanics of that, just how hollow the rhetoric versus the practice is. Like, look what happened in the affirmative action debate. And this was notable in all the press covering that Supreme Court decision. I noticed that they were all still committed to this very vague, wishy-washy, utopian, pie-in-the-sky talk. Like, oh, everyone needs to have a chance to get to these places. And it's the greedy Asians that are throwing a wrench in our beautiful picture of equitability and equality in these higher institutions. And the court case is literally, look, you motherfuckers, there is a paradox inherent to this entire system. How can you be equitable at one of the most exclusive institutions on the entire freaking planet?
Mm-hmm.
How do you square that? You can't. And just expecting Asian kids, students, to take the fall to support this delusion is out of line. And this has now been recorded at the level of the Supreme Court. And if you actually read the thing, it's laid out in very unmistakable language.
Are you talking about the Harvard case?
I'm talking about the Harvard case, the Supreme Court
SFFA,
decision.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's like this is what it came down to. You wanted Asian kids to suffer material harm. And you can quit like all that quibbling about, oh, how much harm can you really have suffered? Instead of Yale, you're going to Georgetown. Fuck you. That's not the issue at hand here.
Also, why, if it's so gaslit, because it's like they're saying, why are you making such a big deal out of this? And I'm like, no, but you're the motherfuckers that are making a big deal out of this.
Yeah.
You're the ones that are putting this policy in place and saying that this is absolutely crucial. And if you don't do it, your whole system, your whole project is going to fail and all this stuff. It seems like it is a really big deal to you. It's like it can be a big deal to them, but it can't be a big deal to us. That's the thing I don't understand. Like, dude, both sides committed a lot of resources to this fight, but only one side was accused of taking it too seriously. I don't get it.
And that's Asian kids.
Yeah.
And it's applying group level punishment for group level, I mean, individual punishment for group level crimes. Like, okay, let's say Asians as a block actually are guilty of these vague moral transgressions against Black and brown people. What does like a Jason Chen from Stuyvesant High School in New York have to do with that? Like, is it okay that he suffers a loss? And by him going to Georgetown instead of Harvard, what did that do to our collective crime tab?
Yeah.
Like, did it do anything? Or are we all just stuck in the level of this extremely childish, wishy-washy shit that doesn't move the needle on anything practical in anyone's life and really just serves as rhetorical cover for extreme institutional corruption? Like institutional, like terrorism on the population at this point. Like, why did they think that this was, like, did they think browbeating was going to be able to go on forever? And everybody, all the yellows are just going to file into the ballot box and tick off to vote blue all the way down forever? Like, that's delusion at some cosmic scale.
Yeah. Well, have you noticed that it's over? Like you don't, I don't see much, like, you know, like I feel like, you know, the people who were making the handful of fucking people, first of all, that's the other thing. This was a tiny, tiny, almost completely dismissible sliver of professional people, countable on like two hands.
Mm-hmm.
That were making a big fuss about this in the media and claiming that they represented Asians and they were the voice of the Asians that had no voice.
Mm-hmm.
And they just went away. Like, once they were no longer needed, once the case was lost and everyone decided to move on, they're just gone. Like, they just don't. It's over. Like, there was so much talk about affirmative action, and this person would write in the New York Times, and then Jake Caspian Kang would write in the New York Times, and this and that, and everyone was, oh my God, what's, you know, this, everything's at stake, and then they lose, and then nobody ever talks about it again. It's just over. It's done, you know? I'm just surprised. Maybe I'm not surprised. I didn't think it was going to be a big deal, but like, the whole thing was abandoned so quickly, and I got to say, I'm like, where we find ourselves now, I feel like that it's just fucking over. Like, all of that territory was just ceded, and now, because they got their fucking asses kicked, the Democrats, I mean, and Trump is in his second term, and Kamala and that whole brand of politics was roundly rejected. They've decided, you know what, we don't need you guys anymore. And they just got the boot and they're just done. It's over. You know what I mean? Like, and I realized, like, you know what? No amount of arguing with them, no amount of like shitting on them or shaming them or whatever mattered a shit. The only thing that mattered was that they won the case and they lost the election. Mm-hmm. Actually, in fact, the more, you're right, the more shit that they got from people like us, the more it seemed like, hey, they're right. There really is this reactionary, anti-liberal, dangerous element to the Asian American, you know, lurking in 4chan, you know, Asian incel uprising, you know. And then the whole thing was completely out of their hands when they realized, oh, wait, no, this is actually, they're just thinking what everyone's thinking.
Yeah.
And then they show everyone. Proved it at the fucking ballot box, and they proved it at the Supreme Court and all this stuff. And you know what? They were always hired puppets anyway. That's why they didn't care, because they were in it for the paycheck, or they were in it for the careerism aspect of it. And now that their services are not needed, they're gone. And the lesson I learned is, like, this is about power. This is not about consistency. This is not about you know, having the right ideas, or, you know, whatever, being a, you know, think about what you're saying. You know, no, they don't care. This is entirely about power.
And, see, I think at an individual level, I think you're correct. And I think to me, that's part of why, like, the white liberal was so seemed particularly anxious and almost repulsed by, like, collective Asian behavior. Because I think we've collectively all been pretty open about that. Like, the way to get ahead in this harsh shark tank of a society is you do what it takes, you squeeze out a living, you front load all that shit into your kids, get them the best education they can possibly get. You get yours, you defend it, and make sure that you pass on the ability for your children to get on ahead. Like, I think that kind of cuts against a lot of very well-heeled, genteel, liberal ideals of how people advance in society. I think it cuts at a philosophical level, too. I think it really seems like they're committed to the idea of meritocracy at the individual level. This idea of, like, the de novo genius that springs up. And then, like, it's the Elon Musk story. You know, these, and I think I hate Christopher Nolan because he's just absolutely fucking obsessed with the Ubermensch in this sense. Like, oh, this organic genius comes up, nothing can stop him, and he'll just emerge and succeed. That's ideally how it goes. There's this kind of raw element to Asian parenting that I think really upset them. They're like, no, it's you get the clay you get, and you just sort of work it as hard as you can to get it to where it needs to go. It's not really even about, like, nurturing innate talent. It's about giving them the practical skills to get ahead in the situation that they're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, you talk about that at, like, a, you know, at a well-heeled white liberal setting, and that really gets people to clutch their organic pearls. It really does.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we want a holistic, you know, we want to nurture them and, you know, foster their skills and their interests, and we want them to be a whole person. We don't want, like, robotic Asians, you know, just drilling math. Like, do you think we picked math because we literally are just carbon-based calculators? Or did something kind of happen in the, say, the late 60s that made math and engineering and the sciences the most profitable industries to get into.
But funny enough, there's suddenly, I feel like the quote white, we'll say white liberals is sort of like a demographic, like, you know, upper income whites in the big city or whatever, but like maybe, you know, let's keep
PMC their, white, let's say PMC, PMC white. White,
but let's think of them just as a demographic rather than a mindset. And I would say my experience has been there's profound shifts with them as well.
Good. Because I think they needed it.
They needed it. And also I think that they are experiencing a certain kind of precarity as well. I know people will mock the idea that people in the top 10 or 5, hell, even 1%, could experience something like financial precarity. But if you look at the distribution of wealth within the 10%, it's even more unequal than the overall. Wild. Right?
A ski slope.
It's a exponential explosion.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying that I feel sorry for them. I'm not saying that they have real material problems. I'm just saying that the social the effects of living within a band of society, because that defines your social group for the most part, where there's extreme wealth inequality within that band, creates, I think, a new, because it's getting worse and worse, you know. You know, some people are just getting like super wealthy off their investments, and some people suddenly are like way wealthier than you thought because they're getting inheritance and, you know, like that stuff, right? Even though you guys live in the same neighborhood, even the whatever, I mean, like, people live in wealthy neighborhoods and they notice like those guys don't work. You know what I mean? Like, I'm working my ass off. Those guys don't even work. Well, they own their house outright and they probably have, you know, $40 million in the bank that you don't know about, you know, or whatever. But they can't access it all because it's in a trust fund or something, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't know that. You just, you know, I think it leaves a lot of the working PMC sort of like, you know what? I think they're getting to a point, a lot of them, at least, and my friends are all working PMC in the sense that they're not trust fund babies. They worked for what they got. Are starting to recognize that. They're starting to lose their class pretensions, which I always thought was a very immature, juvenile thing anyway. The way that a lot of us like sort of play acted to become part of the elite, play acted to be like we're all sophisticated and worldly and, you know, sort of like, come on, let's face it. What were you pretending to be? You're pretending to be wealthy.
Right.
You know, and I think
it was a bit of like fake it till you make it. And now it's becoming clear make it is not in the cards for most of us.
Not to the level of your pretensions, you know, and as you get older, the need for the pretensions falls away anyway. It's like, what do I?
It should. Care? If it doesn't, that's a problem. And we can get to that later.
What do you think about? Let's shift a little bit to what we see. But do you see that falling away? LA is so interesting because I think the particularly for like Asians, like do you sense this among Asians in LA? I do. Just like when I'm there, that there is a lot more class pretension in LA, and I wonder if it's because among Asians, like, I don't know why, but like, because I actually feel it's because there's a larger PMC of Asians and Asian scale heights that they these days that we didn't used to scale. Like they're like mega directors in Hollywood, like super successful Hollywood people are like Asian now, like John Chu, super successful tech CEOs, like not like, oh yeah, there's an Asian CEO. No, the fucking CEO of the day is an Asian guy.
I think we have a pretty like
the owner of the LA, you know what I mean? Like Asians go all the way to the top. And I wonder if that actually makes us or does it make Asian? Sorry, I'm just. I know this is very long, but like, does it make the sort of like class pretension game in LA like even that more pronounced? Do you know what I mean?
I don't think so. I think it's actually a pretty normal distribution. Again, because it's like an it's like a whole country ecosystem. Right, because we have literal like Asian billionaires, both Asian American and like I don't know, like Asian billionaires taking up like either like you know, like Arcadia, San Marino, the San Gabriel, the tip, the northernmost parts of the San Gabriel Valley, and into like Bel Air, Beverly Hills, the canonical like uber wealthy, rich zones of LA, all the way on down to like the poorest strata. There'll be a ton of Asians there too. So I think like you just sort of naturally sort.
I'm talking about the upper middle class to wealthy group of Asians, like the professionally successful.
I think you'll see some, but
this is because from my outsider perspective, my friends in Southern California self-report that it's pretty fucking bad out there in terms of
the need to
signal sort of success and lifestyle.
I understand what you're saying, but I think they self-sorted into a very particularly narrow, very kind of fragile, in my opinion, social stratum. Like Asians of a certain level of income / like total wealth out on like the west side of town, basically working kind of in between these high value industries. Like if you're like a real estate agent, or like you work in real estate in some manner, or like a high end service industry,
tech,
but like a tech worker, not a tech owner, right? And I think like the traditional PMC workers, like lawyers and doctors, they kind of have their own bubble, and they have their own like status of their own that isn't related to like needing to drive a slightly more expensive car than you can comfortably afford because you're trying to sell real estate to a person in a much higher tax bracket.
Well, the game that I saw every time I go out there, real estate. It's so real estate driven, and people will be like, you know, that guy owns three houses, you know, shit like that.
See, I live in the San Gabriel Valley, so I don't see that at all. But that's because I self-sorted into this area. Like everybody everyone's comfortable. Like they have good incomes, good educations, but like there's no, I drive a Prius, right? Like like I can technically afford a better car, but I don't want one. I don't feel nobody looks down on me for having a Toyota. Right? Like
I guess I'm of the opinion. I know like, cause I don't personally, I think okay, let's put it this way. I personally think I self-sorted out of the dominant culture.
Okay.
Which is for the PMC, which is one that is racked by relativism. That's my opinion.
Are you income relativism? What kind of relativism are we talking here?
Yeah, wealth. Wealth like,
relativism.
Wealth relativism, meaning that they're really they are very preoccupied with comps in the area, let's put it that way, meaning they're very preoccupied with the lifestyle of people that are kind of like, you know, close to them, but they're living way better in a certain way, or like, oh, I think they have a lot more money, or you know, like they are really concerned about these things, but in private. And because and here's the thing, I don't fault them for it. I think the reason is because that the financial the managing finances in the higher income brackets is complicated, because with the higher income immediately comes, for most people anyway, much higher set of liabilities.
Debts
and liabilities. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they're suddenly balancing, you know, tuition, vacation spending, mortgage, all that shit. We know all of it. And so it becomes tricky because it's like the more, it's like more money, more problems, you know, like more money, more liabilities, right? And so, but it's a lifestyle driven thing. And that the problem is that what is it all for? I mean, all of it is for your kids to live a certain way, you know, it's to afford a certain, and I don't think they're like greedy, you know, I don't think they're like, I need a golden toilet. And I don't even think it's really about, I want to show off my car. It's not even really like the sort of vulgar thing. First of all, cars are easy to buy now, right? You just lease them, but like
fucking 96 month car loan.
Yeah, I mean, they're
with the 96 month loan.
People are just leasing cars these days. You know, they don't give a shit.
Yeah, but I know. Like, I don't know.
My point is that it's not simple, like class. You know, my car is better than yours. It's not that crude. It's actually things like my kid is getting a better education. Like I'm living in the good school district. You know, I've socked away something of like, you know, a trust fund or a safety thing for my kid, or do you know what I mean? Like it's like legitimate in a way, but also excessive. It's not simply like, I'm going to flex on you with a better car.
If there are Asians that are playing that game and are very
loads,
precarious
that I know loads
in LA,
yeah.
I feel extra sad for them because this is possibly the one metropolitan area where that's the least necessary. Predominantly the people that I grew up with. So this is a limited data set, admittedly.
You're the only Southern Californian I know who thinks this way. Wait.
Let me expand on that. I'm saying that there's so little need for that. The predominant thing that I see is like the hunt for value. So it's not like, oh my God, I need to afford this, be able to afford this $3 million little like shoebox, this premium mediocre shoebox in Marina Del Rey or something. It's, no, if I have $3 million to spend on a house, I am moving inland and I'm buying a fucking mansion in a gated community surrounded by other Asians out in the middle of freaking nowhere. And then the power of that collective draw brings the boba and the restaurants and the higher and the better school ratings
to me. I see.
So it's a value play. So
yeah.
If you're out there in like Venice Beach or Santa Monica or something stressing about min-maxing, like, that's on you, bro.
You're saying that there is a it almost sounds like what you're saying to me is that there's a separate, a distinct Asian, it's more Asian, basically.
It's very Asian. It's terraforming. It's not saying, like,
It's interesting you point that out, because I start to understand what you're saying now, because there's another side to LA, right? Where, and there's another side to New York City, too. Which is this sort of like ethnic enclave mentality. And I agree that the value system within the enclave is very different. And for example, let me throw this at you. Like I work alongside a woman who lives not far from me, actually. She's more towards into the Long Island area. She has a daughter. And she's the same way, you know, she's like really like she wants to keep, well, without going into too much detail, let's put it that way. When she got to know me, I felt when she came to my office, I felt like she wasn't sure what to make of me. And then as over time, as we talked and she realized like, oh, actually I'm very much into like value. I'm very much into low spend. I'm very low key about my consumption and status markers and stuff like that. She actually felt much more comfortable around me and then started telling me, she's like, oh yeah, me and my husband, we're like super fucking frugal. You know, like we live in a unfashionable neighborhood. We just want our daughter to go to a really good school because we heard this one has full of Asians, you know, and nothing about her, in my opinion, is almost to a fault, by the way, because I think that she has a hard time fitting in at the office. She can't. I'm a little bit better at faking it.
Mm-hmm.
But she kind of brings this sort of like Queens middle class Asian sensibility to the office. And does that make sense to you? Am I kind of barking up the wrong tree, the right tree here?
I get what you're saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're referring to?
Pretty much.
Mm,
It's just, it, Like, there's a distinct set of people, like a distinct mentality here, where it's like you can either bust your ass to fit in an already like overcrowded, very commercialized environment that really has very little oxygen left in the water to support incumbents. Mm-hmm. I mean, to support newcomers. Or you take that money and you go literally like 20 miles east, mm-hmm, or something. And do this shit yourself. And from the numbers, there's more people willing to take option two than option one. Because it's kind of recognizing group power here. It was the same growing up. Like, the city I grew up in had real estate covenants in place up until like the 70s. So fairly recently. I looked at the contract for when my parents bought their house, and it actually still was written there that the owners were not allowed to sell to non-white people. It's just that it was unenforceable by that point. But that shit was still there.
Yeah.
And like,
it's very recent history. Yeah.
Racial. It's very recent history, but it went from a place that was like 90% like Protestant white, basically, mm-hmm, to like 75% Asian in the span of like 15 years. And property values skyrocketed. The commercial districts boomed, the schools shot up to the top of the ranks in California. It was a very middling school district until the Asians showed up. Mm. You know, with that kind of representation of group power, it's like, well, then why do I need to go cram myself into a rundown apartment in the worst part of, like, I don't know, Beverly Hills or something, and just like not fucking go to Roland Heights and live like a king with my people.
this is a subculture, though, in a way. Right.
Like, well, it's the dominant from the, if you want to take, I mean, real estate is pretty well documented. So if you look at
but I mean, just the way that, I guess the way that Asians, you know what, I think what you're saying is broadly applicable across a number of places. I would say it's true on the East Coast as well. Like, let's just say in a small, much smaller metro area. Well, maybe not much. It's pretty big these days, but the DC area. There were neighborhoods that were considered like less fashionable because they're further away, and you know, like, you didn't have like diplomats living in there and stuff. It's kind of far to the north, you know, you got to drive an extra few exits to get there. And there's a huge influx of Asian immigrants into the DC area because it's loaded with jobs in tech and government and everything. And I think that what the Asians did, you know, they looked at some of these areas that were really convenient. They had good transport. They had, you know, they had a subway line there. They had groceries and stuff, but it just wasn't fashionable. Like, it was kind of like, you know, people thought of it as the sticks, but the newcomers, they didn't have that. They didn't have the preconceived notion of fashionability at all. It wasn't even that they didn't know that area wasn't fashionable. They didn't understand they didn't really think about the concept of fashionable or not fashionable. They were just looking at value, and they were like,
it's pure value play.
Yeah. These are nice houses. The school district, we, and like, just entire like social media forums that are all Chinese, or, you know, I'm sure there's Korean ones too. And mm-hmm, where they have their own independent assessment of whether that school is good. Like, they don't read the Washingtonian magazine. They have their own assessment of whether Wooten High School or Richard Montgomery or whatever is like a good high school. Whereas the people who like grew up there were like, oh yeah, those are, you know, those are like second rate. Like, you want to be in the private school, or you want to go to Whitman, or, you know, whatever. And so they would just pile in. They're like, yo, the school's good. The housing is plenty. The houses are like pretty, you know, affordable. Let's go. And they would just pile in. And then slowly that neighborhood, you know, suddenly loads of restaurants came to service them. They terraformed the fucking place. You would probably feel quite at home in some of these northern DC suburbs because of how many Korean and Chinese businesses come to cater to these people. And it looks a lot now like, you know, an ethnoburb that, mm-hmm, that, and, you know, pretty much they made it their own. And I find, yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
I guess the question, mm-hmm, to people, to maybe Asian people specifically, who are playing that kind of status game on the margins in these already very built out, you know, status heavy regions of LA. Like, I hope they're getting some kind of value out of it that isn't, you know, that isn't reflected in the balance sheet necessarily. Like, there must be something that keeps you there playing this game. Like, you certainly can't be selling, you know, high end commercial real estate if you live, you know, 30 miles away, maybe. So I don't know. So I would like to know. I don't know too many people like that. Like, the people I know who live there, they like the culture in that area. They can very comfortably afford it, you know, and power to them. But I don't know too many people who are like striving on the margins of these places. By far, the story that I know is you know, people that I grew up with, you know, spend a little time making your way in the world, and then when it's time to actually put your roots down, you make a very cold, calculated value place. Very few people actually even live, you know, in the canonical like LA area. They're all like terraforming out east. It's it's fabulous out there now. Like, I know you've been through over the years, but like, it's crazy how developed it is out
there. I bet. Yeah. No, I'd love to see it. I used to hang out with this one guy, and he lived in West LA, and then he and his wife, he's Korean, she's Filipino, I believe. And they had a kid, then they had another kid, and they were like, screw it, we're packing up, we're going to Cerritos. I think one of them was from there.
Yeah, and Cerritos, Fullerton, these huge like ethnic corridors, like Orange County is basically an ethnoburb of its own now.
I went out to Roland Heights and shit, and, you know,
yeah,
this is a long time ago. I'm sure it's completely, you know, built up even more than it was then. And yeah, you know, like, what I like about these places, I will say, because I've straddled these places a bit, right? Like, I kind of grew up in between. Like, I'm comfortable sort of like in, I see it all as part of like one universe, right? I'm lucky, I think, in that way. What I like about these places is they really are, you know, they just do things their own fucking way. There is a sovereignty to it where they're like, immigrants are, I think we used to rail against the assimilationist mindset, but actually that was more of our own, or my own mindset, where I was kind of like constantly feeling this pressure to be like, yeah, but ultimately don't we have to, you know, and even, do you remember there was like a Fung Bro, remember Fung Bros? Do you remember that?
Oh yeah.
Remember they had a video about like, you know, like growing up in the SGV, San Gabriel Valley.
I remember that. No
burbs.
Yeah.
And then he was like dating this girl, and then she sort of graduated from that bubble and moved to like West LA and got a job at a fashionable company out there. And then she wouldn't date him anymore because she's like, dude, you're in the bubble. Like, I'm in the real world. You know, like, there was really a sense of like, that's a starter community. That's a, that's a ghetto. And your job is to get out of the ghetto. And I'll be honest, I think a lot of what drove some of the podcasts that we did before was, I think some of us on this pod, without naming names, felt that that is actually how it works. That Asian people don't want to admit, younger, especially like, you know, sort of second generation youth or third generation even or whatever, don't want to admit that the reason that they're, quote, stuck in their ethnic ghetto is because racism and exclusion, particularly of Asian males and undesirable Asian females, precluded them from doing what you really want to do, which is sort of enter the and assimilate into the mainstream of white liberal culture. That's my view on what was oftentimes for me, kind of a frustrating back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that, and I think I agree with you. My perspective is always like, if this is a ghetto, like, sure, I'm never leaving. Like, our primary problem is, you know, not being able to get back into it, right? Like, I can't afford to buy in the city I grew up in. And this is the same for basically every single one of my friends I grew up with, except the one who married the day after high school graduation to a 40-year-old man. She's the only one that I can remember who was able to like afford to live there. Again, because she married a 40-year-old like Taiwanese real estate developer at 18.
Yeah. Hold on. Can I
get some? Yeah.
So, yeah, I, you know, it's just
like the ghetto's good. If this is a ghetto, may, please, I don't want to leave. And as far as assimilationism, if you just look at, you know, by now the second generation, you know, roughly the second or third generation since the post 1965, like this shit is good. Like we're not talking about like people being able to, I think for a while assimilation means being able to like, ape the aesthetics and the culture of the higher of the dominant majority class. And being able to prove that you can perform just as well as that you know how to do what they know how to do. I think we're at a point of maturity where there's a level of synthesis that is coming into maturation that I really want to give credit to. Like just looking at architecture, right? Like I know like a lot of people, you know, criticize like immigrant aesthetics when it comes to interior, you know, decor or tastes in tastes in architecture or something. And it's criticized as being like low class or unsophisticated or tacky, exactly.
Which it often is, let's face it.
It often is. Like, I grew up hating the McMansions, and I still hate the McMansions that crowd certain parts of Arcadia, because that shit's just garish. Now you look at, you know, like, now we're at, like, 20, 30 years out from that point, and you see, like, I really want to move out to one of these, like, more eastern, like, these like, little ethno-burbs that are a little further out. These houses are amazing. And they're all, because of the high presence of Asians, they really led the way on doing things like making it legal and streamlined to put up another unit in the backyard.
Like an ADU type thing?
Yeah, like mm-hmm. Like basically multiple houses on one compound. That's really attractive to me. I would love, I want to have my parents near me as they get older. This whole like running four households is not tenable. But like the only way to tap into that lifestyle is moving further out or get into like a 5-year, you know, fight with the local, like I forget, like go to City Hall every day to fight for a year to get this shit zoned out and permitted. Mm-hmm. And then spend like $300,000 to build another house in the back. So in terms of lifestyle, quality of life, and then the sheer value represented, like what 3 million buys you in like Marina Del Rey, or Venice Beach, and what 3 million buys you out in like Roland Heights, that's a different country, basically. Yeah. Like I don't know how to like I don't know how to make myself want to live that life out on the West Side. Cause we're still talking about people who have a comfortable living. So it's like you have options. You are very much making a choice to live this way. I would like to know why people choose to do things the way they do. I'm not judging. I just want to know.
For me,
I imagine they have good reasons.
For me, I would say this is a pretty deep question. I don't think it's a simple. I don't think it's a simple matter.
Okay, I have a question though. Not sorry to interrupt you. Like your friends that you're talking about, are they transplants or did they come up here?
They're mostly from there. They're mostly from
this area.
Yeah.
And they still do this. Interesting. I just want to chat. I want to talk.
You know, they're highly educated. They went to great schools. They come from a decent amount of money, most of them. Mm-hmm. So their parents are
middle, upper middle.
Some of them are just outright wealthy.
Oh, okay.
And I think what happens is that their social circle includes some people who are pretty outrageously wealthy.
Okay.
And I think that the presence of outrageously wealthy and sometimes famous people and all that stuff acts as like a distortive effect.
That does.
And that's one reason why I got to tell you, I really fucking hated Silicon Valley. Mm. Was because everyone was like, you never know who's worth $30 million, you know, like, and there was this whole thing, like the presence of that kind of money, and it was stealth money. You didn't ever really know who was worth that much. I always felt it had a very corrosive effect on the culture and the mindset of people. It provoked, I think, a lot of paranoia mm-hmm. and jealousy, and people didn't trust each other because of that. They were always, you know, they were always worried that their position wasn't as secure as someone else's or whatever. It was a narcissism of big differences. So does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. That yeah. does have a distortion field effect.
Yeah.
I'm pretty fortunate that I limit, like basically everybody in my innermost circle are people in roughly the same circumstances.
I think that's really nice, to be honest. Like, I don't really like big differences, and I don't like, you know, I don't like the unspoken, people. You know, it's all through behavior and not spoken. And if it's spoken, there's a lot of like codedness where it's, I sense this all the time. There's a constant sort of dick measuring contest going on. But it's done in a very class coded way. And I have no patience for it because I find it boring, and I can't have real conversations with people because so much stuff is off limits.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think this also plays out differently for men and for women, to be very honest.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Mm. Contrary to stereotype, I think men are far more sensitive to the status games than women are. That could be a bold and very wrong statement, but just from my point of view, it always just struck me that men are the ones who are like scanning the room and constantly doing these reads. And maybe I've been fortunate. I being a woman, I've always worked in kind of male dominated spaces. I've always, you know, when I'm earning, I earn a pretty good amount. Like, my friend started joking and then it stopped being a joke. He's like, you're actually like a pretty fair, you might be a better man than a woman on the dating market. And like, ha ha, ha. Oh fuck. You might be correct. Shit. Mm. So being a woman in that space, yeah. it's like it puts you in a different headspace, maybe. But like by far, like every time I've gone to some place and then like some kind of dick measuring happens, it's called dick measuring because dudes are the ones doing it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I say dick measuring just because I'm a man, handbags. And that's only know my side of it. But I would say
there isn't really that game for like women or something.
I don't agree. I think it's like men. I think some men play this game and some don't. I don't. Some women play this game and some women don't. I know women who play that game, you know, yeah. and I mean, know others who don't.
It's a generalization. It's just, mm-hmm. I don't know.
I think it plays out differently. I mean, I think there's probably differences
men take
in how
it more
plays
personally.
Out.
Yeah. I think men take it more personally if they feel that they are slipping in the status game. Whereas it's kind of, mm-hmm. It's a little more acceptable for a woman to be, you know, not the alpha of the room, you know?
Yeah.
But I think men take it more personally if they feel like they're not measuring up to all the other dudes in their vicinity.
Which, by the way, I mean, maybe we're at an hour, but we could discuss this in the bonus. But I wanted to address, okay, well, here's the thing. If we reject the status game, mm-hmm. what does that mean? Like, then what? Okay, so does it mean you just don't give a shit at all about your, you know, your material stat, like you don't care about material status at all. You don't care about anything. You have no standards, you know? So I think we could address that in the bonus. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. All right. I got big thoughts on that.
Okay. So we'll continue this, in the bonus part of this pod. It's part two of a 2-part podcast. And if you want access to, the bonus content that we put out, it's on our separate Patreon feed. If to support and get access to that in the Discord, go to patreon.com/planningmag. All right.